I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
United States wine history is varied and unique, and it dates back pretty far. In previous segments, we've explored how some of the first vines in California were mission vines planted by Spanish missionaries. And we've talked a little bit about Thomas Jefferson's experiments with vineyards. And also about how, more recently, Constantine Frank pushed for vinifera vines in the East Coast area in the 1950s. But one part of U.S. wine history that is often overlooked is the contributions of Italians who came over in the late 1800s and early 1900s in search of a better life. Many brought winemaking traditions with them from Italy, and there are several elements in U.S. wine culture today that can be traced back, usually through Ellis Island, to Italy. Well, today I have a different sort of dad tale for you. Over the holidays, I sat down with my father-in-law, who told me about how his grandfather made wine in the basement of a townhouse in Brooklyn, and how that wine was the toast of the neighborhood.
And I grew up in Brooklyn, and my grandfather used to make wine in the basement of an Italian slum, 993 Pacific Street. Grandpa learned to make wine in Naples, outside of Naples, where he had his farm. His dad had his farm. His father was a Carmine. And Grandpa used to tell me stories about, well, back in Italy, if you had a farm, you didn't live on the farm. You lived in the town. And his job as a boy was to walk the mules out to the land from the town. And his father taught him how. And so that's where he learned. And he come over here as a young man, as a young boy, a teenager, at the turn of the century. Yeah. And then the father come over.
Through Ellis and everything?
Yes, definitely through Ellis. In fact, us kids got together, grandchildren got together and bought him a brick. Wow. Put his name on it. Oh. And if you look at the census records, they just butchered their names and everything. Grandpa used to go out to Jersey to get his grapes, and he made wine all during the Depression. He come to this country at the turn of the century, but he made wine all during the Depression because they allowed Italians to have wine because it was a cultural thing. And or even during the Prohibition, they could have the wine. And it was very much sought after by all the people in the neighborhood. And he would have this big wooden grape press. It was wooden, all right? And to a young person, the most prominent feature of it was what I call the propeller, which was the big wooden arm, both sides of the screws, and Acme threads. And it was, to my eyes, was huge. And if I were to see it now, it probably wouldn't be that big. But to me, it was as big as could be. Big screw that you turn that thing and it pushed the lid down onto the grapes and squeeze the grapes, and the grape juice would come out the bottom. And then my aunts, who hated the job, had to stomp on the grapes at the end of it. And they were young and they hated it. But they had to do it. He had five daughters and one son, my father. So my aunts had to do it. And Grandpa would bottle it in whatever he could. He had barrels, and he would pour it out of the barrels. He had spigots, and he would put it in the bottles and stuff after it fermented the proper amount of time. And his favorite expression was, you can't cook it too much, and you can't cook it too little. And it was, you would put it in Heinz ketchup bottles or whatever was handy, and people just would do anything for Grandpa's wine. And it was in this, and again, 993 Pacific Street back in the, it almost doesn't exist now because the whole neighborhood's been torn down. It was strict Sicilian Napolitan neighborhood. And it was a dirt floor. Again, it was a slum. It was not high-end living. But Grandpa had that going on in the thing. And yeah, it was just so great, I mean, to grow up with it. He didn't care for white wine at all. And it would be the cardinal sin, a mortal sin, if you ever put ice in his wine. But, and they would, at the end of a big dinner, they would, in the summertime especially, they would make this big bowl of the red wine, and they put peaches and oranges and all this other, these other kind of fruits in it. And they would let me have that. And it was just so good. And yeah, Grandpa's wine, it would go down and it would make you sit down.
Hey, you, wholesale buyer type person. You listen to the show. You know who is making good wine. But how do you keep track of where to buy it? Well, 750 has you covered. Powerful, easy-to-use browsing tools with all kinds of ways to drill down to what you need. Lots of vendor information, including company background, contact info, and even a link to a vendor's Facebook page if they have it. The power to make out tasting lists of wines you've enjoyed. You can keep those online for as long as you need them. You could refer to them for years, even. And a constantly updated list of tastings in your area. You want to know what tastings are happening tomorrow and which are happening in 2 months from now? Where are they happening? 750 has you covered. Have you checked out 750 lately? You should. It is a wholesale buyer's best friend. Go to 750.com for more information and to get signed up. Jeff Kellogg on the show. Myelina. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today, Levy?
Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well.
So where'd you grow up?
Canton, Ohio.
What was that like? Big wine town?
A huge wine town. Nothing but. You know, it's a middle-sized town in Ohio, and not a ton going on in the wine scene there. But, you know, to be honest with you, just left when I was 18. I think like a lot of kids that grow up in small towns and want to get out and do bigger things. So left for school and never really came back. But a great place to be from is the cliche I would use.
Your family's from wine background? Or?
No, not at all. It's a big family. I was the youngest of six. And we would, you know, have dinner together every night, but there was never, ever wine at the table. You know, mom now has developed a great White Zin habit, but always an open mag of Beringer White Zin in the fridge. It's incredible.
Gotta have those gateway wines, right?
Yeah, exactly. But no, we didn't. I never saw wine at the table, or we never drank it when we went out to dinner, or, I mean, maybe on Thanksgiving, one of the uncles would bring it over, but no, it was not a wine background at all.
What was the entree? I mean, what was kind of the move at the moment?
You know, when I was in college, I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was working at a like higher end steakhouse there. You know, I kind of, as a waiter, I kind of knew that like learning about wines would make me more money, because
sure.
I can remember just thinking like, 97 cake bread was as good as it could possibly get, because I had no context for the world of wine. And I can remember a staff training that this overambitious sales rep did for us, whereas like I tasted like champagne, my first Chateau Neuf, he pulled out Riesling at a steakhouse for some reason. Like, it was just this lineup that I was like, I realized that there was a lot more to wine, and it wasn't just like who uses the most ml in their shard and that means it's the most better, you know what I mean? So the next day I went out and bought what probably everybody buys as their first wine book, Kevin's Raley's. And, you know, I've been broke and reading and trying wines ever since then.
So you're working at a steakhouse. And then what was the next move in your restaurant career?
After that, I moved to Charlotte, mostly not for really any good reason. I was done with college. I dropped out. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I loved wine and I loved restaurants.
You were probably making good money in restaurants at that time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would assume way more money than I'm making now.
Right. No, but that I was too.
Yeah, sincerely.
Like late 90s, before September 11th, like cleaning up.
Yeah,
like,
no doubt.
You're like, dude, I'm making more money than my parents. Like,
pharmaceuticals didn't have all the rules that they had now.
100%.
It was the Wild West when it came to pharmaceutical steakhouses showing off. So, yeah, the money was pretty great. So I was enjoying that aspect of it too. So I moved to Charlotte and met some people that were opening a restaurant. And just assumed that I would be there for like 6 months. I had some other friends that were moving from Ohio there. And so, you know, just to kind of, oh, this would be cool. Let me open a restaurant with these guys. They seem to know what they're doing. They're pretty bright. And then, I mean, 6-7 years later, I'd opened up 4 restaurants for them and a wine bar concept. And it wasn't until, so Charlotte was a lot longer than I anticipated it.
What was the wine programs like?
Not great. But I got to oversee the wine programs and open up restaurants. And, you know, really I was a manager who oversaw the wine program because I had the most wine knowledge. It's not as if we valued the wine program so much that, so, I mean, Charlotte is not New York when it comes to a wine market. So there was, you know, it was buying Malbec and Shiraz and, you know, people pleasers and that kind of stuff. But, you know, there was no, like, you never see Graveno out in Charlotte. You never, like, those are just rumors that, like, Rioja exists. Like, you just read about it in books that it's supposed to be amazing, and you're like, and you try to find it, and maybe you get to taste it every so often. But so, but what I really learned that I think a lot of young somms don't get to is, I mean, I had to manage people and schedules and labor and P&L, not just for the wine program, but for the restaurants, and open up restaurants and do all that. So, I mean, when I get into a new job, you know, one of the things that bosses immediately like about me is that I understand the numbers, because, you know, there's so many, same thing with chefs too. There's so many chefs that get promoted to executive sous. And it's like, so what's the formula for cost again? And you're like, oh, yikes.
What were some of the learning curves for you?
Some of the, I mean, the learning curves for me were really, you know, trying to do something progressive in a company that, you know, with the wine program, in a company that it just wasn't, it was a great restaurant group. It just wasn't, the concept wasn't to be progressive. The concept was to kind of throw fastballs, not curves, not educate. So, and the learning curve for me was like that classic SOM story where you're just banging your head against the wall because you're trying to do something cool, but it's, you're just in the wrong concept. It's not that they're wrong or you're wrong. You're just with the wrong people. So, I mean, I, after banging my head for a while, you know, it was just like, oh, this was great and I learned a lot, but it's time to move on. Probably a little bit later, you know, looking back in hindsight, probably a little bit later than I should have.
But it was also, that was a different time. Like, there weren't so many articles about sommeliers, and like, it wasn't, didn't seem like a genuine career in a way. It seemed like, oh, this is the one I've got, but I don't know if there's so many other options. You know what I mean?
True. Yeah. You have no idea what's out there. I mean, you knew obviously it would be better in San Francisco or New York, but you didn't really, there's like, you have no idea how to get in or like what to do or like who to meet. And you don't really meet many people hanging out in Charlotte. Like then,
right. People kind of like coming through.
Hey, so, you know, there's this guy in San Francisco doing some pretty great stuff. Like, let me connect you via email and maybe have something like.
Right. And you're not following him on Delectable or Instagram.
Exactly.
There's none of that. So.
Exactly. Yeah. That wasn't around yet. So, you know, you just kind of figure it out as you go. But I knew that, you know, there had to be more things that I could do because somebody's buying all that Burgundy and selling it and drinking it. It just wasn't happening where I was.
I remember like books would come out like the New France and stuff. And I would read those books and be like, oh, I've never heard of that producer. And yet this guy says it's like the best guy in that appellation. I wonder why we don't have it or why this market doesn't have it.
Exactly. How have I never seen that? That's crazy. You know, the other thing is that you read producers that are supposed to be, that are, you know, amongst the best in that area too, right? And it's, and then you, when you finally get to a place where you get to drink those wines, you're like, what are they talking about? These wines are terrible. So you don't even get to like, but you don't know enough at that time. Because
oh,
you
to appreciate the wine that you're
tasting. Yeah, so you haven't tasted Raveno yet, right? So when somebody brings you this hot new Chablis producer that is actually not as good as people say, you don't even know. You're just like, oh, everybody says this is great. So right. This must be what really good Chablis tastes like. And then, you know, 5 years later, you're like, man, I can't believe I ever didn't have the courage to be like, yeah, these aren't very good.
Yeah, I'm tasting a lot of oak. Yeah.
Exactly. I don't think we need to name specific producers, but.
So what was the next move? You get out of Charlotte and what happens?
You know, it's funny. I was like, I sent my resume to a lot of people because I knew it was time to get out. But, you know, even though I was so naive, so I thought that I knew a lot about wine.
Right. Easy to do. You didn't know what you didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I would reach out to fill in the blank of like a wine-centric, like MENA group and on. It was like, yeah, you know, I think we have something for you in Atlantic City. And I was like, oh man, Stephanie is not moving to Atlanta. Sorry, Atlantic
married,
City people.
Dude.
Yeah, exactly. So the next step was a resort in West Virginia called the Greenbrier, which was an amazing job. Tried really hard with the wine program. It was definitely like next level, like definitely discovered wines that I didn't know, got to taste a lot of stuff and was, you know, a pretty unique place. And the wine director there at the time was Heath Porter, who had I mean, you know, loves Burgundy and just like the rest of us, but definitely his favorite is Italian. So getting to work with him really opened up my eyes to Italian. Because, you know, I talked about how there's not much French stuff going to some of the B markets in the South, but there's the Italian you get to see. Like, I can remember literally telling my sales rep, I don't understand it. Italian wines are terrible. And now looking back at what they were bringing me, it was just, I was right. The Italian wines they show to you are terrible.
You're like, this gold label wine, terrible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And that's like the one that they show you. Like, oh, you're looking for a Chianti. Well, this is the only one you need.
This is the, yeah, this
call
is the one.
Call it a day.
Yeah. Fill in the blank for the number of cases and we'll call it an afternoon.
Exactly. I'll make this real easy trip. This is the only Chianti you need. So that really opened up my eyes. And that's where like the love of Italian wine came from, was from Heath.
And that was like DeGrazia days, like rocking modern Barolo, or what was the deal?
There was a little bit of modern Barolo, yeah. But, you know, it was also, there was also some like of the old Chatterton stuff that somehow found its way there.
It was weird how sometimes Chatterton would get into markets you'd never expect. You know?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, when Heath got to West Virginia, you know, there were some great wine directors there, but, you know, him trying to get the wines that he loved was reaching out to the importers, and they're like, oh, can you recommend a distributor in West Virginia? Because we're not there, and we're only going to sell to you. Like, I'm not going to send a sales rep there. So it was
more like DI. More like, I'm interested in this. Can you bring it in for me? That kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of stuff like that. I remember Domaine Select had a big presence in our wine program as well, and that could have been just because that was one of the first people Heath reached out to or whatever. But
no, I remember they were in Massachusetts too, so they probably did more outreach. Because it was the same. There wasn't so many Italian wines, but Domaine Select was there.
Like, sure. Yeah, back, yeah. You know. Yeah, I can. We were pouring, like at the steakhouse in the resort, Movia Sauvignon by the glass. You wouldn't think that that would be like the
That
move,
would be the one, yeah.
But, you know, it worked. And there was definitely a little bit of a thirst for something different.
Higher acid whites were kind of coming up, whether it be Gruner or some of those Italian wines, you know, less well known.
Yeah, know? I mean, yeah, like, absolutely. I mean, I think we had much more luck with Italian reds than Italian whites.
Still today, I'm sure.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, especially for the price point.
I spent most of my time at the steakhouse and resort, too, so I mean, for obvious reasons, that was...
Right. What do I have with my shrimp cocktail? Oh, maybe I'll get a glass of wine before this $200 bottle of red.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, it was like, what should I have with the oysters? And then you would, like, oh, this is the champagne we're doing by the glass right now. And they're like, no, I meant what red wine.
Right.
Of course, my mistake.
Let's move right to the Brunello. But what was the Greenbrier like? I mean, what was it as a place? What was it like?
Pretty incredible. I mean, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on there at the time. They were changing concepts and opening up new stuff. There was a new owner who was a local guy who seemed, I mean, he kind of seemed like a Steinbrenner of like the hotels. Like he was a local guy, wanted Greenbrier to be great and didn't care like how much velocity had to take to make that happen. So, I mean,
all but it was a busy place. Or, I mean...
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely seasonal. It's not like in February in the mountains of West Virginia, we were killing it because it wasn't a ski resort. It was more of a golf, old school, like been around for hundreds of years, golf resort where the wealthy from like DC went and stuff like that. So, I mean, in season, it was crazy busy, like 700 rooms, all booked. And it wasn't inexpensive. So it was a great clientele to get to work with, too.
But off season, that probably meant you could hit the books a little bit, right?
Yeah, a little bit. It meant that she wasn't my wife at the time, but Stephanie also stayed in Charlotte, so it meant I could drive to Charlotte a little more often and get to see her.
Seal the deal.
But yeah, there was a coffee shop in town that I definitely spent a lot of time studying at during the off season. On season, forget it. It was 7 days a week, but I mean, they started hosting a PGA tournament while I was there, and they. Hosted a Vander Holyfield a boxing match like at the resort.
When still
while I was
had
there.
The ear? Or?
No, that was way post ear. I can just remember, I can't remember the name of the guy he fought, but like trying to get into the main dining without a dinner jacket. And you're like, well, we have these jackets over here and no way those fit you. So this is going to go really well.
But isn't that the place with like the presidential bunker or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Exactly. There's a bunker below where. I can't remember where it was built, like in the 40s or so. And that's where they were going to send the Senate, like in if nuclear war happened to it. I don't know the whole story, but like Washington Post leaked it in 92, which was probably great for the Greenbrier because now they give tours of it and it's one of the things they're known for. But it kind of shows you like how much history is there and like how cool of a spot. I think it's something 20 some, maybe 30 presidents have stayed there over the course of time.
Basically, your wine cellar is like a presidential bunker.
So it turns out it's much more lucrative to use it to give tours of than to store wine, yeah, unfortunately.
From the Greenbrier, what happens? What's the next on the...
So I was a year there, and I'd say if that job was in like San Francisco or New York, like I probably would have stayed there for decades because it was a lot of fun. But I also kind of realized that, you know, when I was working in Charlotte, if I could go back, like what I probably would have done is traveled Europe, done some internships at wineries and things like that. But so I'd never worked production.
And how old are you at that point?
So I was nearing 30. I was probably like 28. So I wanted to move to California so I could work production, you know, via buying all that California wine in Charlotte and West Virginia. I had some relationships out there. So I went and worked a harvest at Saintsbury, brought my wife with me, and just assumed like, well, I'm going to work harvest for 3 months, and I bet you I'll be able to find a somm gig at the time, because I was naive and I had no idea. Like, when you move to a new spot, especially from across the country and nobody knows who you are, it's really hard to get a somm job. So pretty naive. But, you know, in the way that things sometimes just work out, the apartment that we found in Napa, which we got sight unseen before we moved there, a manager at Red happened to live in the same building. And so I became friends with him. They needed a sommelier. And so, like, I'm sure they were probably better candidates, but just through, you know, people liking you and you being just a laid back guy that people tend to get along with, like, I got a job that maybe I wouldn't have if it wasn't for that random connection of being in the same apartment building as Paul Stroud, you know?
You're like, I'm glad I brought that mail over for you, bro. Like, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Glad we had that Tupperware party.
Do you need me to walk your dog? Or what can I do, man?
And they have Red and Redwood, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I worked at Red for a bit and then opened up Redwood. It was the opening somm there. And then a little while after the opening, went back to Red. So that's where, you know, really I got to work with some somms that, like, mentored you. Like, getting to work with Willie Shearer was incredible.
So that's, like, post-Ariel days? Or?
Yeah, exactly. So when he left Vegas and moved to Napa and took over as wine director at Red.
I only hear, like, really good things about him from other people who have been on a show. They usually say nice things.
Yeah, he's pretty... I mean, he's been around for a while. He's still working the floor. He's not one of... Which is... And this is rare in California, not as much here, but... Like, has no desire to do things. He's a sommelier, which means I work the floor, and I love it. And so, I mean, just getting to taste with him and get his perspective on wines, you kind of learn, like, what things are supposed to taste like and what's actually faulted. And, you know, what I talked about before, where you don't know, like, everybody just says that these wines are amazing, and nobody ever writes it really flawed. But people who like flawed wines will be totally into these. Like, you can hear, from, like, no, so this is what happened with this wine. Like, you can like it if you want, but it's not really my thing. And he's encyclopedia of vintage knowledge. I mean, to the point where we were joking about, I can remember, like, mid-70s Oregon, like, somebody had brought one in. He was like, and he was rattling off, like, 74 to 78, like, what those were like when they were young and what they're like now. And we're just like, who knows that? Like, that's insane.
And he was a nice guy.
Yeah, very, very, very. Definitely somebody I stay in touch with. I can still reach out with questions or mostly just sarcastic texts making fun of, you know, his wine or one of our friends or something like that.
But Redwood had, I visited a while back, it had a fair amount of Italian wine. Was that a thing at the time?
Yeah. When we opened it, it was probably half Italian and half Napa, which, you know, that half Italian part, people take for granted that, oh, there's a great wine culture in Napa. I bet people are really into drinking something from outside of the neighborhood. And that's not true at all. There was definitely a lot of like, why is it not just, there's a lot of Calitals being grown out here. Why? So that was a little bit rough at first. But again, I got to get more perspective. And that was
like
a pretty...
Like, the locals saw that they felt you weren't always supporting them 100% is what you're trying to say.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, all of this should be ours.
Exactly, yeah. You think you're doing the right thing because like 2/3 of the buy the glasses... people within a square mile or something, and it's like, yeah, it's 66% is great. You know what's better? 100%.
You know, I sell wine, and so do these other 10 guys.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
All come into your restaurant, that kind of thing.
Yeah, very much so. But, you know, it was a pretty inexpensive list, so it also opened my eyes to not just blue chip Italian stuff, but like all the really, like, the Pigattos and the Ruques and the Pilavergas and all that cool stuff that maybe... you don't even read about in books unless you're like way deep into some geeky Italian books. Nobody really writes about those, but that's some pretty cool stuff to serve at a pizza joint. So, I mean, that was a great experience too, to get to taste with Willie, watch him put together that list, and really get like exposed to a lot more of Italy than just Barolo, Super Tuscans, Brunello.
How long were you with Reddington?
Probably about a year. It was probably, yeah, literally like probably just short of a year between the two places.
And what was your next, thinking?
So I wanted to work some more production. I'd done another harvest where I volunteered at Gargiulo, so I got to see some high-end cab. And
What was that like?
It was really interesting because, you know, Sainsbury's a little bit more eclectic and, you know, they've been around forever. So, you know, they're one of the OG, like, Carneros people. So, like, you can't throw surprises at them. They know what they're doing. They have a formula. Gargiulo is like that, you know, two different sorting tables, picking out jacks, like super pristine and like really high end, you know, immaculately made wine. So it was pretty interesting to see that aspect of winemaking too, because we mostly visit and read about, you know, people making crazy stuff out of garages or their basement in Burgundy. And so to see like the other side of it up close and be into it was pretty neat. But I wanted to work somewhere that was maybe a little bit more like mom and pop. And so I reached out to Greg Harrington and went and worked at Harvest in Walla Walla, Washington. I bet that was definitely the most educational winemaking experience for me.
How so?
Because there's no formula at all. You know, when grapes come in, like he tastes the stems and calls out how much whole cluster we're going to do on that. He's always in the vineyards. Like there's no adding acid. There's no adding sugar. There's none of that stuff. And so you literally get to see more of the vintage variation and, you know, how to battle that with winemaking techniques versus like what you're putting into the wines. But also he's so accessible in that he, like, since he was always there and his assistant winemaker Brandon was always there working, that you can ask them questions like, oh, what would happen if you did this? Or, hey, doesn't so-and-so do this? You know, and they're every vintage, I've gone back the past 2 years and they do something different every year. They're trying something new that Greg saw when he was visiting, you know, like Alamont, or they're trying something new with the temperature. This year they just got concrete to ferment in. So they're always evolving and just trying to make something better versus like trying to make something that tastes the same year after year with hopefully a higher score. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So via that process, I
probably felt like some different grape varieties too, right? Like then, hey, it's just Chardonnay, Cab, and Merlot. Like it's not really his thing, right?
No, I mean, he makes that some Bordeaux grapes, but the first year when I was there, it was the first year he messed around with white, and that was just a little bit of Vignier. But like when he makes rosé, like he's not, it's not like Saunier, like byproduct. Well, he's trying to make the best rosé that he possibly can. But it was cool to work with like Syrah and Tempranillo and seeing him visit vineyards to kind of decide what he's going to do and buy. And when I was there, he messed around with Sangiovese. I don't think he ever bottled it, but to see him like, Chachi is like his idea of what Brunello is. So to see him like try to make Chachi from like Washington
State,
I mean, it's a pretty ballsy move, you know what I mean? But instead of just like, hey, Sangiovese will sell well, let's just get something in bottle, like he was going after it, you know?
Right, he had icons that he was kind of moving towards.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, sometimes you fail just when you're trying that big, but at the end of the day, like in terms of like being able to make wine when I left working a harvest, like that was the one where I actually learned like how to make wine and what to do and could actually probably do it after working that.
Did that help segue you into a new sommelier role or what happened?
Yeah. So working harvest there pretty much bought me 3 months to find a job. And, you know, I was going to go back to California. My wife was still living in Napa. And something opened up at RN74 while I was in Walla Walla. So the timing worked out perfect that I could come back and start at RN and get to work with those guys and get a little bit deeper into Burgundy.
So that's a big place. I mean, that's nice that came together. What was that like?
It was great. It was so much fun. I learned so much, got to work with some great people, got to taste unbelievable wines. It's such a big step in the evolution too. I don't know if anybody ever tells people anymore that like, so if you want to be a really smart sommelier, like, you can study all you want and read about these producers, but if you're not working at a place where you get to taste those wines all the time, then you're really, really missing out. And that's what that place was. Like, I can, you know, obviously I knew about Ravino by the time I got there and had tasted it quite a bit. And But I mean, by the time, like, work 6 months at RN, and like when you get blinded on Ravino, you'll be like, this is definitely 08 Ravino, but.
So you're not just like, I think I'm in Chablis.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I can remember starting there and like tasting, getting blind and being like, oh, I think it's Merceau. And it was like a Pulini, like, from like Le Fleuve or something. I'm like, oh, that was really close. I'm pretty good, huh, guys?
Yeah, and Chardonnay, then like 6 months Burgundy. Later.
6 months later, you're like, no, this is okay. So I know this is Rouleau. The only question is this Michevaux? I think it is. I'm going to call it.
Because Roger's a really good taster.
Incredible. You know, you think, like, people talk about Raj so much that you're just like, so much of this has to be fluff. Like, just because he's a good dude, like, I'm sure people over-exaggerate, but he literally is as good a taster as people say he is. I mean, talk about calling producer in vineyards, like, on the regular. It's pretty incredible to watch. So, and not only that, but, I mean, Railsback was still there. Chuck Ziegler's an incredible taster, and there were some other great tasters there as well. So, I mean, that's where you really get to learn to taste, like, you know, not like Court of Psalms, Court of Master Psalms method, where it's like deductive, calling everything out, but like spending 30 seconds with him being like, yeah, this is Dovi.
One of the things I realized about Raj is after a while watching him do his thing is that he seems to be looking at soil type first and then working back from there.
Yeah, kind of working backwards on that?
Yeah, I feel like he says, okay, this is limestone. So what's on limestone and where's limestone? And mm-hmm. then he kind of takes it that way, or granite or sand. So it's not really like the MS boxes, because he doesn't go, the color is medium dark. Because when you're dealing with classic appellations of Europe, you can kind of go from soil type back if you have enough familiarity, and it kind of narrows you in. You know what I mean?
Sure, yeah, completely. The other thing that I think people miss out on is that, to me, it's, you know, everybody focuses on like calling village in Burgundy. To me, it's actually almost easier to recognize producer. Like, when you can figure out, like, it's easier to figure out what Donjaville tastes like than it is to figure out what Volnay tastes like, because there's way more differences in Volnay producers than there are in wines, you know, at least is my feeling. So I think when you get to taste those producers and get intimate with the producers, it's much easier to get to the village, because when you know the producer, it's obviously easier to get to the village.
And a lot of the producers are coming by RN, I feel like, when they're in the States, so you're probably meeting dudes and...
Yeah, yeah. So you get to literally ask questions, and you have access, and you get to meet everybody. So, I mean, that's a huge thing, to get to taste those wines all the time, to get to meet the guys so you can pepper them with questions, because there's only so much that you can do on Google, you know, especially when it comes to France. Like, you can find out anything you want about California vineyards, but French vineyards, it's still, you have to meet the guys who farm it, and you have to ask questions about the history or what they're doing different, when they started doing that. When so-and-so started making the wines and all those things that you... They don't have it on their website.
It's not on the website.
Yeah.
And what was San Francisco like as a city?
I loved it. I had a great time. I mean, I'm a city guy, but really great community. Like, I made friends in a minute. When I was still in Napa, I was lucky enough to get in some pretty great tasting groups. Like, there was one still going on at the fifth floor. Like, there's been a lot of legendary Psalms who were in tasting groups at the fifth floor. There was still one going on. And we had a great one at Bourbon Steak in the St. Francis with some of the best Psalms out in California. So it was really easy to make friends. I got really lucky that way. And so the other thing about San Francisco versus New York is that you're off the floor at like 10:30, 11. Like, your 9 o'clock reservations may or may not show up, where in like New York, like, your 10:30 reservations are showing up. So you're off the floor late. But in San Francisco, you know, we could be done and meeting at NOPA or you know, meeting at Rye at like 11:30, because everybody's done for the night, which is vastly different than meeting at 2:30.
I remember being at the Slant the Door at 9:30, and then 9:45, 10 o'clock came around, and it was complete Andromeda strain. Nobody was there.
Yeah.
Like, empty village. Even like when I left, I had to find my own coat in the coat check, like, because no one was there anymore.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Turn out the lights. And when we left was probably 10:10 on, you know, like, and that's a place that's busy. Like,
yeah, no kidding.
You're there at 7 and there's 350 people there dining.
And nobody's taking those 9 o'clock reservations, even though that's the only thing available.
So then I wondered, like, why is that? You know, because every place you go that's not NOPA is like that, I found, in San Francisco. Unless you go to a neighborhood that's catered towards late night, it's usually done by 10. So it took me a long time. I was like, why is that the case? Because I'm not used to this, and this is odd. And then I realized that all the money works on New York time. You know, like all the money needs to be up at the time New York is up, which means it has to be up early.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
You know, 3 hours difference, so... You know.
Well, there's that. Then when I was there, there was also, I don't know why they were not late, but there was also the kids in hoodies that were working in tech that were also out spending money. But for whatever reason, they were at cocktail bars at 11:30 instead of being at like Slant a Door or RN or whatever.
It's funny with San Francisco because you can't tell who's the young kid in tech and who's the young kid just like cutting high school.
Yeah, living in his mom's basement.
Yeah, you're like, because
you guys look the same.
Because in New York, I feel like you don't see just kids wandering around. Like they're usually like at their internship, working 80 hours a week. They're not just wandering the streets like looking for trouble. You know what I mean? But like you actually actively encounter that in many neighborhoods in San Francisco. It's like, well, don't you guys have some place to be like making rent money? You know what I mean? Like just scraping by just to pay rent? Oh no? Oh, because you live in San Francisco. That's why.
Yeah, right. Meanwhile, they probably just had a startup that just went IPO. And
right. And he's like...
They're laughing at us.
Yeah, Krug 89 is good, but I prefer the 88. You know, that kind of thing. I've definitely met some dudes like that in San Francisco. So, Chadillac, what's he like? What's the inside story on the Chad Ziegler, huh?
There's a lot of inside stories on Chad Ziegler. Incredible to work with. His knowledge of vineyards is, especially for somebody who's like only 12 years old, is like wild. He did the smart... I mean, he was working that internship at the laundry when he was like 21. And like, you know, he did the right things. He worked a harvest at La Fleuve and pretty calculated, really smart. So his knowledge of Burgundy vineyards especially, but the Northern Rhone is outrageously good. Great taster. You can always ask him questions, always learn. Great taster. Like blinders, like incredible. Like never missed one. But he also... could hit things that weren't classic. You could give him California stuff or, and he would still get it right. Like he wasn't only about Burgundy. A lot of fun too.
That's the impression I've gotten from meeting him. So Mina Group, you're working with them. And then what's next?
You know, I was in a really good spot. I really enjoyed working there. I was working with great people. I had always thought that, you know, I'm going to want to live in New York someday. I've always told my wife that, you know, hopefully we get like 6 years on this planet. And if we don't spend a couple of them living in Manhattan, that would be a pretty giant waste. So, you know, I was in a good spot. So if something opened up where they wanted me and, you know, I wanted to work there, then, you know, I would take it. I assumed that I would have been at RN for a couple of years, but it turned out I was there for a little, I think a little bit less than a year when the gig at Maialino opened up and I talked to Regan about it. And I thought it was a great opportunity. I thought it would be a lot of fun.
How did you meet John?
You know, that's a good... I'm not sure how I met John. I think just via, like, Court of Master Sommelier stuff, somewhere I met him. I'd actually talked to him about a job earlier when I was in Walla Walla, but there wasn't really anything. So when that Maialino thing, he put an ad, I reached out, like, we just talked immediately. And, you know, I always, like I think a lot of people in restaurants, I read Danny's book and, you know, kind of eyed his success and, you know, more so his philosophies, because... if you work at enough restaurants, you're going to work for some chefs or owners that are not very nice. So like there's this philosophy out there, like an owner whose core belief is like taking great care of not only his guests, but his employees. Like that sounds incredible. That's where I want to work. And so reached out to John. We interviewed a couple of times. I came out here, met with, you know, the team, and I was New York bound.
When did you arrive?
June of last year, 2013. So I've been here just about a year and a half.
And it seems like a lot of changes on the list. Like when I looked at it back in the day and when I look at it now, it seems like a lot of difference.
Yeah. I mean, one of the great things about that group is, you know, even John, it's not like they tell you what to do. Like you get a little bit of a long leash, you know, and it grows over time if you're doing the right things. But, you know, you can put your imprint on the program and do what you think is best. And if it works out, then you get rewarded, and if it doesn't, then, you know, they kind of work with you to make it better. But so far, it's been great. You know, the list that I took over was so much fun and so cool. A lot of eclectic stuff and stuff you don't see, and some vintage depth on some, you know, things like Foradori, Toradigos, and weird stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun to take over. You know, I think when we looked at it, my thought was that there was a lot of room to grow with the classics. And, I'm, you know, when it comes down to it, I love eclectic wines as much as anybody else, but... you know, I love champagne. I love Barolo. You know, I'm probably more a little bit more of a classic lover than a lot of Psalms. But I thought that's where there was room to grow. And I had no idea in New York how much access you have to vintage great producers and old vintages. I would have assumed that it would take me 5 years to get the list to where it is now in terms of vintage depth and great producers, and not just great producers, but kind of the quote-unquote B producers from, you know, the great vintages, and to get those on the list at prices that are affordable even for sommeliers.
When did it start to dawn on you that New York was a little different?
A couple months in. You know, I knew that, you know, everybody talks about New York and how crazy and how big, and so you're like, yeah, of course. And so my first couple of months, I mean, I got to work like 3 days after getting here. So I didn't really like soak in New York before I got to work. So I just got to work, and I had no idea like how big it was at the time or how unique. I mean, you think there's probably like that small handful of Psalms that you know about because, you know, they're either big on Instagram or, you know, like they've done some pretty great things or, you know, whatever. So, but it turns out there's like these really smart Psalms all over that you have no idea about because they're at some 40-seat restaurant in a part of Brooklyn that you didn't even know existed. And they're doing incredible things with their lists, and they're all over. Like, it's crazy how many different spots you can go to, and there's just amazing stuff being done. It's pretty humbling that you'll never be the smartest. You might be able to be the smartest in one small category, but, you know, you could think you're a giant sherry geek or something. But then you find out that there's a spot for some reason, like East Village, that just has like this incredible sherry collection and has wines that you didn't even know existed. And it's really humbling like that way. So I found, I think after a couple months when I started to like look at other people's lists and actually get out on the town, that I realized that, oh, New York's even more different than I thought.
It seems like in terms of Italian wine, the market at the distributor level is pretty fragmented. It seems like you could be dealing with a lot of different distributors to get three Etna Rosso might be three distributors, you know.
I would say that's usually the case. I think there's a lot of history, I think, to that that I can't really speak to because I've been here for a year and a half and I think it's before my time. But from when I hear, you know, stories from the guys who've been buying for a while about like who used to carry these wines and, you know, what went on with them and stuff like that, that it sounds like there's some pretty unique stories about Italian wine specifically in New York and who sells them. But I think, you know, Italian wine, you have to really work to find all those wines because there are so many, there's so many distributors you only want to buy two wines from. But you really want to have those two wines on your list. Otherwise, your Ruque section isn't complete. So, I mean, you have to work really hard at that. You have to work really hard at the auctions. You have to work really hard with secondary sources. And so, you know, it's a grind if you want to have a unique, different, but really great Italian list.
Someone were coming in and you were like, hey, you're going to work in an Italian restaurant? Let me tell you a few things.
Yeah, one is, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's just successful. It's being somebody that people want to work with. So just being cool, being nice, treating people well. You can't always give...
So how do you do it, though?
Well, I have my SOM team deal with that.
Right.
So they don't
have
know.
People for that. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, you always want to outsource the things you're not good at. So being nice, obviously, I have Katie and Erica and Paula take care. You know, I think that the advice I would give is to just kind of find your niche, like decide what you want to be really good at and be the best you can at that. Because you, with Italy, you can't be the best Southern Italian and have the best Barolo and have, because somebody else is already cornering that. So just kind of find your niche and do it. But I would also say trust your palate too, because you're going to find a lot of opinions on Italy like, oh, you don't carry this one, this one's the best. But like, just whatever you think is right, that's what I would go with. You know, the fun thing about Italy to me, especially coming from a program that sold a lot of Burgundy with age, is old Barolo is delicious and it's affordable for now. I would even, this will be controversial, but I would say, in my opinion, maybe like the best Barolo maybe isn't as good as like, you know, Rieschborg at the, you know, in terms of the highest highs. But those B producers from like, I would much rather drink like one of the outs, like, the 10th best producer from Barolo with 40 years of age than I would the 10th best Burgundy producer with 40 years of age. And so that is so fun to work with. So, I mean, it's affordable stuff. So explore it and have fun with it.
And what have you been excited to find in terms of older vintages or producers from, say, Piemonte?
So I've been shocked by, I mean, it comes and goes, unfortunately, but like the old Caremas from Ferrando have been, like when I can find them, are for the most part pretty incredible. Unfortunately, like I'll, you know, you'll find three bottles of like the 89 and then like you take a day off and you're like, oh, where are those three bottles? And Sam's like, oh, we sold those. Those were delicious.
This one table loved it. They got all three.
Yeah. So, I mean, the good news and the bad news is that we have so much success with them that it's a grind trying to keep them in stock and find more, which is not an easy thing to do. But, you know, obviously, like the old Quinternos and the old Mascarellas and stuff are, for the most part, going to be pretty delicious. But, you know, Franco Fiorina and Accomasso and like some of the producers that literally, to be honest with you, I didn't even know existed when I took over this Italian program, for better or worse.
I think both of those are pretty under the radar.
Yeah, and the 78s from both of those producers are great.
78 Accomasso is killer. The Rocchetta, awesome.
Yeah, those wines are incredible. And they, you know, again, a producer nobody's ever heard of. I bet you they're on my list for under 200. If they're not, then it's really close. And so, I mean, find me that value like in another wine region.
Right. It used to be there with the Rhone, maybe not with quite as much age, but used to be able to rock the old, you know, 15-year-old Klopp for, you know, 115 or whatever. But that's,
yeah, unfortunately, those days are gone.
Long gone. But I'm sure one day we'll look back and be like, dude, remember when you used to be able to crack the 67 Barolo for, you know, 250 or whatever?
Those, I don't think those days are far away from when we're laughing about what we were paying for these wines in 2014. So, you know, we might as well enjoy it while we can, because...
What do you think about Nebbiolo as a grape and Piemonte as a place? I mean, if you're coming up with descriptors for understanding these subjects, what would you say?
It's my very favorite red wine region. Because it's, you know, it has so many of the great traits of Burgundy, but, you know, in the best cases, I think even more aromatics. But I think you can do so much food-wise with it because of that structure, because of even more acid than most red Burg, obviously more tannin. And the different levels of tannin as it ages is so much fun to work with, you know, different fattiness levels of food, or sometimes not even fat, but, you know, how much mushrooms you can work with. They're just like savory, earthy, obviously truffly ingredients. So in terms of like working with Italian food, it's so much fun to work with.
Do you think there's regions inside of Italy that have yet to kind of bubble up to the top of the pack like Piemonte has, but that someone might look to and be like, wow, pretty exciting?
You know, that's a good question. I think you would agree that Etna's kind of the rage right now. But, I mean, I think we would be talking about regions that age very well.
Yeah, I have a big question mark on Etna and aging.
I was going to say the same thing. So, I mean, I think that's kind of up in the air because I think so much has changed winemaking-wise in Etna that, you know, even when you're tasting like early 2000s right now and you talk to that same producer, they've changed so much about what they're making that I don't know if we... I mean, I don't know enough about that region to say. I would say, you know, I think Alianico, both from like Campania, I think Volturi is probably a region that you could make some pretty great stuff. There's just not many people doing it. But dollar-wise, those wines are dirt cheap, and I think there's huge potential there to make some pretty great stuff. For white wines, I think Friuli is just head and shoulders above, you know, even what they're doing in Campania. I don't know about the ageability, but the white wines from Etna, I actually would rather drink a white wine from Etna than I would red in many cases. I think Terranieri's white is delicious. I think what Salvo Fodi does is delicious. Marco De Bartoli, I think that Grillo is shockingly good.
Yeah. Sabibo too. You're like, oh, this is a Muscat with some mineral character?
Yeah,
crazy.
And crazy amount of acid as well. Yeah, that wine's pretty eye-opening as well. You're like, this is the best Muscat I've ever had.
Yeah. So... this is the first situation, as far as I can understand, where you kind of hired your own team as a sommelier, not as a manager. So what was that like for you?
You know, again, it speaks to what Union Square, where they never, ever say like, I don't know. We don't have somms at the restaurants other than the Modern, and we're doing okay. So why don't you just do it on your own? Like, present the idea to have somms. Tell them what you think, what kind of impact it'll make on service and sales, and they're open to it, you know, which is amazing. It was a huge advantage when I was trying to higher psalms that we have the reach that USHC does. Because if it was, you know, just a Roman style trattoria owned by some dude named Jeff Kellogg, probably wouldn't have been able to get the talent that I did. But it's also like, I think, lended credibility to the team, to the wine program with the talent that we got. You know, getting Eric O'Neill from Frasca and getting Katie Morton from The Nomad and Paula Rester from Congress. I mean, that's really solid Psalm team for the first three hires. So it's been a great experience. They've all lent kind of their unique things to the program and they're all awesome. So it's just made us such a better restaurant at the same time. And I know it's changed. It certainly helped the other USHC restaurants as well in terms of like, oh, maybe Psalms are a good idea. And I think you can see, I mean, the job that Regan's done in bringing in Michael Engelman to the Modern and Michael Scafidi and the job that Mia does over at North & Grill and then getting Jack Mason to open up Marta. So, I mean, I think what John's done in terms of building the wine program as a company has been incredible.
Why do you think Italian is so popular in New York? I mean, what is it about Italian? It seems like it's become kind of de facto dining in a lot of ways.
For whatever reason, there's a real accessibility to Italian food that just feels like every day, you know, whether it's pizza or the pasta that we do or, you know, all the salumi and cheeses. And there's just something like so easy and casual and everyday about it. And, you know, from a wine director perspective, there's something about Italian food as well, where it just seems like obviously you would have wine with it. Like, oh, we're about to order pasta. Like, even though it's like one's a carbonara, one's red sauce, and they're still like, obviously we're going to have like a bottle of Barbera with this. That would be barbaric if we didn't, you know? So there's just something I think so easy and everyday and not, it just seems like something you can do anytime without like much planning or stuffiness.
So a little bit over a year in New York, big changes on the program in terms of hiring and then what's on the page at Maialino for the wine program. What's going to happen in the next year for Jeff Kellogg?
I think one of my goals in 2015 is to actually study for the EMS so I could sit in 2016 because I've put that off for the past 2 years now just because I've been grinding so much at work. I think that in terms of that program, you'll see it continue to grow in a guest-friendly way. Every time I make a purchase, I always think, you know, my goal is to make it the place that I would want to, if I was thinking, where do I want to drink Italian wine? I want that place to be Maialino. So I think it'll keep growing in terms of things that other people don't have at really remarkable prices. So, I mean, while maybe you can find, you know, Ferrando from the 70s at other restaurants, I'm sure, I know you can. But hopefully when you look at their prices, it's $100 more or something so that people like, you know, that make sommelier kind of money can actually afford to drink him and enjoy it. And it's not just for the expense accounts. You know, other than that, I would say I just want to get to know New York a little bit better. We'll be here for a while, but, you know, it changes so fast that I don't want to miss out on anything. So hopefully, you know, having a great team behind me now, I can get out and have a little bit more fun, continue to learn. But I mean, I don't think that much will change in terms of who I am this year. I don't think you'll see me like trying to rock as many wine and food festivals as possible or start tweeting Instagram and like a maniac or anything like that.
You're hurting feelings now, bro. So looking back, you know, on your career, what would you tell the younger you in your 20s, now that you're in your 30s, what would you say, you know, if you could go back and be like, hey, man, well, you know, maybe think about this a little bit more. What would be your advice to the younger you?
I would say travel as much as you can, like while you're young and have no responsibilities. And then I would say, you know, in terms of work, you know, just skip college and that student debt altogether and get some life experience. But that's a personal thing. I had no business being in classrooms. I can't sit still for 20 minutes, but nobody ever tells you like when you're 17 and you can't sit still for, hey, maybe college isn't for you. You should find a field where like that's a plus.
Right, right. Where you need to be moving all the time.
Yeah, exactly. But I would say the best advice I can give to myself or somebody like that 20-year-old who's like, man, I love wine. How do I get into the business? This is hard. And the answer is find somebody you think is really smart who, for whatever reason, like doesn't hate you and took it, you know, takes a little bit of interest in you and just learn as much as you can from them and be an apprentice. Like just be a humble apprentice. Learn from them what you can and have them help you kind of grow because you're not going to do it on your own. And you need some friends and some mentors if you actually want to learn.
seems like your path through wine kind of took you to bigger and bigger markets, and so it may have been less evident to you that wine culture was changing. But does it seem that wine culture has changed since the late 90s, early 2000s for you in terms of what a sommelier does or what they can do?
Yeah, I think it's changed pretty dramatically. One, the fact that there are so many, there's actually jobs for sommeliers now. You know, when I talk to like, you know, the Willie Shearers or the Larry Stones, and they're like, yeah, everybody had one somm. He was the wine director, and he was the only one. So on his days off, there would just not be somebody if he took days off, you know, that kind of thing.
Even John Reagan at EMP, when he started, was just by himself.
Yeah, exactly. That's such a great example. But now, you know, what I found out when I was trying to hire somms is that everybody has six somms on their team. So it's so difficult to find somms just because of that, unless somebody is like hates their wine director or has just been at a place for 5 years, so they need to move on. It's really hard to find talent because there's, at least in New York, to a lesser extent San Francisco, there's so many somms who have jobs already. So I would say that's a huge difference. I don't know what it's like. You know, it's been a number of years since I was in Cincinnati. I know it hasn't changed in Charlotte yet, but I don't know what it's like in the rest of the country in terms of if people are getting to hire somms besides the wine director, and if people are noticing what a great help that is, not just to sales, but also the level of service your restaurant can give. But, you know, in terms of what people buy, I've definitely seen, like, you know, through recessions, et cetera, spikes and dips in what the average price of a bottle sold is. In New York right now, it seems like business is pretty great. Nobody really blinks an eye at things that I would think that they would blink an eye at.
Jeff Kellogg, he's had a long career in wine and a new entry into New York. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks, Levy.
Jeff Kellogg of Maialino. Hey, you, wholesale buyer type person. You listen to the show. You know who is making good wine. But how do you keep track of where to buy it? Well, 750 has you covered. Powerful, easy-to-use browsing tools with all kinds of ways to drill down to what you need. Lots of vendor information, including company background, contact info, and even a link to a vendor's Facebook page if they have it. The power to make out tasting lists of wines you've enjoyed. You can keep those online for as long as you need them. You could refer to them for years, even. And a constantly updated list of tastings in your area. You want to know what tastings are happening tomorrow and which are happening in 2 months from now? Where are they happening? 750 has you covered. Have you checked out 750 lately? You should. It is a wholesale buyer's best friend. Go to 750.com for more information and to get signed up. That was our show. If you're curious about what we're up to in the future, check us out on Facebook. Give us a like and you'll see all our fancy, fancy posts. It's I'll Drink to That, Talking Wine with Levy Dalton is a Facebook fan page. Hey, fan page. Yeah. We're on Twitter at Drink to That Pod. And we're also up on Instagram, some pretty artistic shots sometimes, sometimes not, sometimes good though, at Levy Opens Wine. And then I got to tell you, we're also got our own website there. It's alldrinktothatpod.com where you can stream stuff off of it or download direct episodes so you don't have to go through iTunes if you don't want to. We like to give options. We're about options here. So lots to do, lots to think about. Maybe you want a t-shirt. Maybe you like a fancy, well, they're not that fancy, but they're pretty cool. I'll Drink to That t-shirt of your very own in a variety of different colors, shapes, sizes, onesies even. I mean, you can get onesies, you can get tanks, you can get biker tanks, you can get tees, you can get other stuff, hoodies, for God's sakes. It's all up there. You can find the information up on our website if you'd like to check it out and wear what you hear. And then there's also that possibility you could shoot us some real support. Shoot us a little dough. Help keep the microphones rolling. We are here because of dedication, because of love, because of interest. But we're also here because we make the finances work, and we could always use a little help with that. Thanks for your consideration.